Simone Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. May Martinez, a California lawmaker, says no one should get a police officer's badge and gun unless they get a bachelor's degree or turn 25. He'll state his case. Plus, most superheroes wear masks while saving lives. Find out what local city is now using superheroes to get its residents to do exactly the same thing. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up,
we need individuals that know the difference between a sandwich and a gun before you shoot somebody in the back.
One local assembly member argues that police officers need to be older and better educated. We'll tell you why in about 20 minutes. But we start with a high point in the battle against COVID-19. The round of vaccines from Pfizer were administered today to medical workers in select hospitals, giving many hope that we will soon start to see the end of the pandemic. Meanwhile, some 3 million initial doses are being shipped all over the country. First batch has come to Los Angeles County, and it's expected that we may get 500,000 doses of vaccine by the end of the month, assuming that all goes well. Now, here to talk about those developments and what comes next is infectious disease specialist Anne Ramoyne. She's a professor of epidemiology at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health and director of the Center for Global and Immigrant Health. Professor, earlier today, some of the first vaccines were administered in L.A. County, and Governor Newsom held a press conference about this. He was joined by L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti, who had this to say.
It is the hope of this moment, to have witnessed the vaccines that we just saw brought a tear to my eye, because it shows human ingenuity, it shows the stubbornness that human beings have. We want to survive, we want to thrive, and we will make it through this.
Professor Ramoyne, just knowing that this is happening today, how's your outlook on the pandemic today?
I think we really need to take time today to be able to celebrate what an enormous achievement this is in public health history, in science, in the history of science, that we've been able to go from having a virus, a totally new pathogen identified, to 9 months later having a vaccine that's actually out in the arms of people who need it right now. So, you know, we have a lot of time before this is going to be out to the general public, but we all need to take a minute today and really be very, very appreciative and celebrate the good news, which is we are now coming into a new phase of this pandemic.
Yeah, I got to admit, when I saw the first person in Great Britain get that shot, and then the second person was someone named William Shakespeare, which would kind of made me laugh. But it was nice to see. But then to see today, early this morning, a nurse in New York get the shot, and then right here in LA County. I got to admit, Professor, it feels like it's small and it's barely visible, but there's a little shimmering, glittering light at the end of the tunnel, right?
Absolutely. There is light at the end of the tunnel. I think that people need to be really, to really take that in, to soak that in. There is light at the end of that tunnel, but the tunnel is long.
Yeah.
And we are not there yet. And we have a lot of lives that can be saved right now. Because the main, most of the people in the United States are not going to be getting this vaccine yet. So this is the time we all need to double down and to make sure that we are wearing masks, social distancing, and really not going out unless absolutely necessary. We're in a very dangerous point in this pandemic right here in Los Angeles.
Do we have any more clarity on which hospitals will be getting the vaccine in this first round?
You know, I'm not aware of which hospitals are going to be getting those vaccines and what the distribution plan is, but I do know that UCLA Health is going to be implementing a comprehensive plan and that they will be receiving and administering vaccines. I'm just not aware of the specifics.
And just on logistics, I don't imagine that everybody in the same hospital can be vaccinated all at once.
Well, no, this is going to be a process. It's not just about lining people up and sticking the shots in their arms. Yeah. They're going to have to be a registration process. We're going to have to keep track of who's gotten it. We're going to have to give them the information on when they're going to have to come back for a second dose. So there are logistics around this. It's simple, but logistically heavy.
Now, when it comes to those two doses, why do we need two? When I got my flu shot, it was just one shot and that was it.
Well, this is not a flu shot. This is a different virus. It's a different kind of vaccine, and it has different requirements. The reason is this first dose it'll give you a boost, or it will give you this first dose is going to prime your system. And then you're going to get 21 days later with this Pfizer vaccine, a second dose, which will boost that immune system. And so you just don't make enough antibodies at that point to be truly protected without this second dose. And I just want to also point out, there are other vaccines where you need more than one dose to get full effect. And for those people who've gotten the shingles vaccine, Shingrix vaccine, for example, that is a two dose vaccine for the same reason. You get yourself, you get a prime, and then you get a boost.
Any particular reason that you know of for the amount of time between the first and second dose?
Well, when they do these studies, they look to find the optimal time at which you've gotten enough time to make that first level of antibodies, and then when the right moment is to be able to get that boost, to be able to increase it. 21 days is the minimum. It's not the maximum. So people from day 21... probably for a week or two or three after that, will get that second dose.
Now, if someone does get that first shot, just to be clear, they can still be a carrier of the virus.
Whether you get one shot or two shots, you will still be able to. I think what you're asking is, can you get it and pass it on to other people?
Yeah.
So there, no matter how many doses of this vaccine you get, we still don't have answers about whether or not it's going to prevent asymptomatic infection, which is when you can be infected with the virus, still spread it to other people, but you don't know you have it. What this Pfizer vaccine has shown in the studies to be able to do is to prevent disease, some symptomatic disease and severe disease. And those are huge wins. I mean, this is a big deal. But what we don't know is if you could still potentially get infected, have an asymptomatic infection that you won't notice and still pass it on to others. So even if you get the vaccine, you still need to wear a mask just so we don't pass it on to others.
Now, what do we know about when the next vaccine from Moderna might be reviewed for use?
So the Moderna vaccine is going to be reviewed, I believe it's the 17th of December, so it's coming right up. And it's going to go through the exact same process that we just saw with the Pfizer vaccine. So we're going to have the same meetings, same process approval. That's basically it should be no different.
Okay.
And the news is good. I mean, we anticipate, given how similar the Moderna vaccine is to the Pfizer vaccine, that it will very likely be approved very quickly.
One of the things I'm curious about, Professor, is so for people in the vaccine trial that got the vaccine, are they good? Do they not need to get anything else?
Well, with the vaccine trial, you don't know if you were in the vaccine group or the placebo group, the group that got, that didn't actually get the vaccine. Because remember, with these studies, what happens is you're going to have one group that gets the actual vaccine and another group that gets what we call a placebo, which doesn't have any active vaccine, and you don't know which group you were in. Nobody knows which group they're in, not the person that gave the shot, and not the people on the ground. It's only later this independent group, the Data Safety and Monitoring Board, that actually has the ability to look at this. And so we eventually, those people will likely be offered vaccine as well, depending upon what group they were in when it's all unmasked. But because they're still collecting data on these individuals who are in the trial, right now, we can't. We don't know what will happen.
So they're not even. So for the people that got placebos, they aren't told that they have placebos. And even now that the vaccine is being rolled out, I'm just wondering if maybe now that it's all happening, that maybe they can say, okay, you guys got the placebo, so get in line.
Well, I don't believe that the trial has been brought to an end at this point. So when it does, they might now, and it also may be different for people who are health workers versus non-health workers or people who are in those groups that are being vaccinated right now.
Now, England, I mentioned, started giving out the vaccines last week. Have we learned anything from that rollout in terms of side effects and what maybe we can look out for here?
Right. So what we've learned from the rollout in the UK is that we did see a few people have severe allergic reactions. And so the new recommendation is that people who have who have had reactions to vaccines previously don't need to, or, you know, should talk to their physician before getting a vaccine.
We're talking to infectious disease specialist Anne Remoyne. She's a professor of epidemiology at the UCLA Fielding School of Public Health and director of the Center for Global and Immigrant Health. Now, these first doses will go to hospital workers and others considered high risk. When do you expect the vaccine will become available to the rest of us? That's what everyone wants to know, Professor. When is everyone else going to get the vaccine who are not other, essential workers and not otherwise healthy?
Right. So right now, it's all going to depend upon how this vaccine rollout goes, what we learn from it. And then also, because remember that these are both, that vaccine is under an emergency use authorization. So, you know, if we learn anything, it may change the process slightly. But right now, we're waiting to see what happens. We're going to wait to see with the Moderna vaccine. Does that get approved? And then we're going to see about the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And so the more vaccines that we have approved and in the pipeline, the faster we'll be able to have vaccines out to the general population. Right now, we can't make those kinds of assessments because we don't have the data. As a professor of epidemiology and as a scientist, I say, let's wait till we see the data. Then we're going to make those kinds of decisions. But if all goes well, if all of these vaccines look good, if their safety profiles, their efficacy profiles are as good as we think that they're going to be based on what we've seen so far, then, you know, if there's enough vaccine out there, we potentially could see people maybe March, April. I would say that spring would be the end of, you know, late spring probably is a yeah. realistic timeline when people will start to be able to get it. But remember, when we have so many people needing to get the vaccine, it's going to be a logistically heavy task to get that vaccine out to everybody.
What will be the point? I've already worked out in my own head, Professor, that I'm wearing a mask all of 2021, no matter what. The entire calendar year, I've got my face booked for a mask no matter what. But when will we get to a point where we won't have to worry so much about distance and masks so much?
Well, that's another really good question. And then remember, we were just talking about this issue. We don't know if these vaccines protect against asymptomatic infection or not. So even when you get the vaccine, you're probably going to be wearing a mask. I would say that probably a year from now, we'll be phasing masks out in large, you know, in large part. Maybe by the summer, we might be able to do so. But it really depends upon how many people are vaccinated and how long the vaccine lasts. These are things we still don't know, but I'm looking to next. I'm going to make my, and this is just a guess based on
sure.
You know, if all goes well, probably by next summer it'll be less, you know, people will start to wear masks less often. And then by the fall, we'll probably be back to normal if everybody gets vaccinated.
I know that's the other part of it too, right? There has to be a good number of people that decide to actually take the vaccination.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, you know, up until now, the main local messaging about all things COVID-19 have been county pressers from the Director of Public Health, as well as weekly addresses from LA's Mayor Eric Garcetti when it comes to messaging about the vaccine. Is hearing from just these people enough, you think, especially when we got this phase coming up now?
You know, I've been working on vaccination for a very long time. Not just here in the United States, but in places like the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And what I can say is that any successful rollout of a vaccine will need to be based in trust and confidence in the communities and be leveraging all of the allies that we can. So that means that we really need to be building trust. We need to be answering questions. We need to be going to communities and finding out what they are worried about and how we can answer these questions directly. It's perfectly normal for people to have questions. It's normal, it's acceptable for people to have questions about this vaccine, about any vaccine. It's incumbent upon all of us in the public health profession in the medical profession and scientists to be able to answer those questions clearly. And then also get people who are spokespeople, influencers in those communities to understand the data, understand the science, and be able to communicate it. I mean, this is really what public health campaigns in general hinge upon. And so this is no different. We've all got to do our part.
Because you've looked at this when it comes to this issue of trust and reluctance among some in the public for taking the vaccine. You looked at this issue among hospital workers, and I know your study is currently under peer review, but who was in your study and what did you learn?
So what we did was we conducted a cross-sectional study of 609 healthcare workers here in Los Angeles and their attitudes towards a novel coronavirus vaccine in two hospitals here in LA between September 24th and October 16th. And what we found was that a majority of healthcare workers at that time expressed concerns over a novel coronavirus. Two-thirds of the respondents, they stated an intent to delay or refuse COVID-19 vaccine due to concerns about expedited development, emerging scientific discoveries, not enough information, and the political climate. So, you know, I mean, everybody has questions. Now, this was earlier on. This was now, believe it or not, 2 months ago when this information all came, when we did the first round of our survey. And so we've now done a second round and we're doing some analysis, but our preliminary analysis suggests that there's definitely been a shift and that people are definitely more willing to get the vaccine right up front and not to delay. It's also important to remember that these health workers did not overall express concern about vaccines, but it was just about this particular vaccine. And for all the reasons that the general public have had questions, it's perfectly reasonable to have questions. Now is time to get the answers out there.
Were you surprised, though, that even among healthcare workers that there was any kind of reluctance?
Well, I think that it's, as I said before, it's perfectly reasonable to ask questions. And health workers are in a unique position where they may have, a better understanding of science and know the questions to ask at first. But you know, everybody wants more information. It's perfectly reasonable. And I think that the key here, the reason it's so important to get this information out there to the public, is that healthcare workers, they are not only the first in line, as we're watching today, to get this vaccine, but they're also going to be people who are going to be dispensing the vaccine to others, and also people that the general public relies upon for advice about it. So there could be a ripple effect. So for me, the importance of this study, that it was a warning sign, hey, listen, public health authorities, we've got to get the information out to people, because our success in combating this virus is predicated on how well we do in getting this vaccine out to the public.
How important is it, Professor, the person who administers the vaccine to people? I mean, if it's your local trusted doctor as opposed to maybe a government employee.
Well, I think it depends upon I think everything is an it depends answer here. You have to have people administering the virus who people are administering, excuse me, let me rephrase that. People administering the vaccine who are trusted. And I think that that's the most important thing here, that we always have we need to have people out there who are providing vaccine, who are trusted and who can answer questions as best as they can. But, you know, we're also going to have to balance the logistics of getting this out there. I've been working in places like the Democratic Republic of Congo for so long, trying to understand population immunity to vaccine preventable diseases, helping the government actually plan their immunization campaigns and figure out who they need to be getting to that aren't normally getting vaccines. And, you know, the problems aren't any different. They're all the same thing. It's all about community trust, having the right people out there answering questions and just being as transparent as possible, and making sure the information is clear.
Professor Anne Ramoyne, professor of epidemiology and an infectious disease specialist at UCLA, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
All right, there have been countless conversations on how to reduce excessive force by police. A California State Assembly member from Los Angeles has a plan, though. He says no one should be given a badge and a gun until they earn a bachelor's or turn 25. And his idea is driven by data. Here, make his case when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm Amy Martinez. There have been so many different conversations on how to decrease incidents of police using deadly force. I mean, we heard suggestions such as improving implicit bias training or restructuring the rules of engagement. But a California State Assembly member thinks maturity may be one way to start. Reggie Jones-Sawyer represents the 59th Assembly District, covering most of South Los Angeles. And he says that in California, before anyone gets handed a badge and a gun, they need to earn a bachelor's degree first or turn 25 years old. And he didn't just come up with those standards out of thin air. They seem to be driven by data. He joined me last week and started off by explaining why his bill, the Peace Officer Education and Age Conditions for Employment Act, is worth consideration.
It's really important for us to not only have maturity, but we have an educated law enforcement group, and that we come to the highest standards of that.
Now, you're the chair of the Assembly's Public Safety Committee. What kind of conversations have you been having about this, and with whom?
We've heard other police agencies and groups and associations kind of talk about that or have that in their hiring requirements, but it doesn't go far enough. We've got data that shows that the frontal cortex doesn't really develop until you're age 25. And we've obviously talked to a lot of experts on the criminal side. We've had this discussion for quite some time about how young people, if you're 13 and they do a heinous crime, they're not that same person at 53 or 43. And so we shouldn't just throw them away for the rest of their life. So we've already had this discussion on the criminal side, but we've never talked about how to bring people in who carry a gun and have to make complex decisions, sometimes on the fly, about the law and how that law applies to you as a citizen. Wouldn't you want the most educated, the most mature individual that you come in contact with to make that decision? And so if we start changing the makeup of people who come in on the front end, think about it, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you and I can have this discussion again, and we can talk about all the great things that have come out from this, including what I think is people will have a different impression of law enforcement. Their stature will not only go up, but they'll be extremely respected because the standard for getting in will be so high, and the fact that the professionalism as they go through their career will be so great that almost overnight, I believe, law enforcement will see a turnaround in the way people look at them.
Yeah, right now in California, officers need to be 18 and have a high school diploma. I know for the CHP, it's 20 years old. How do you think an officer assemblyman would be fundamentally different if he or she had that bachelor's degree or were 25 before they got sworn in? What about them would be different or change?
I know there were some things I did when I was 18, 19, 20. I don't want to put you on the spot. I'm pretty sure there's some things that if they had cameras or people who had recorded what we did, we probably wouldn't be on the radio right now, and I probably wouldn't be elected because you're not fully developed, and you really do some really asinine things. So from 18 to 25, and we give you a weapon, could have some really adverse impacts. In addition, you get a lot of influences. So police officers come in, they get the right training, but if they're not mature enough to fight off, I'll just say, bad cops who give you bad advice, bad training, that want to get you into sheriff's gangs and things of that nature, you might be more influenced to do things that you would not do if your training instructor was standing right there. And that's what we're finding. There's a gap between how officers are trained, the policies, and sometimes how they act on the street.
Yeah, I know a National Institutes of Health research showed that parts of the brain dedicated to impulse control don't fully develop until at least the age of 25. Is that one of the specific problems you hope to solve with this bill, to at least for an officer eliminate that part of their development where maybe they do have more impulse control?
We believe that could have a significant impact. And we're not the only ones that have tested it. I know a lot of times we in California like to say we are the first, but four states, Illinois, Nevada, New Jersey, and North Dakota require a bachelor's degree as the educational requirement. And 18 states require at least some college. And so we want to put the best, brightest, most mature, most intelligent workforce out on the street. We do that with carpenters, electricians, plumbers, architects. We do that with every other field. Everybody has some kind of intensive training, but not law enforcement.
We're speaking to California State Assemblymember Reggie Jones Sawyer of Los Angeles about his plan to require people to have a bachelor's degree or be 25 before they can become police officers. Assemblyman, you mentioned going after the best and the brightest. If part of the rationale is that a 25-year-old college graduate may have a better understanding of what's at stake personally and professionally, wouldn't it stand to reason there might be a lot fewer officer candidates because maybe they want to make as much or more money doing less life-threatening work?
We've got to do our best to attract the best and the brightest to this job. We should not go to the lowest denominator. This is not a custodial job. This is a very significant position in our community. And so we should go out and not only get the best emotionally trained, but the best trained as far as academics. We want people with the acumen to be able to do the job. And if that means that we have to work a little harder to get more in, then let's do that. I gave the example to individuals who were worried about whether or not we would get more African-American and Latinos in. And I just said, well, I think part of the problem is we don't recruit well in law enforcement. In addition, I believe we should, especially if you're going through CSUs, we figure out a way you can pay down that debt. Let's make this job attractive by saying that we'll either eliminate your CSU of debt, or we keep the salary at such a high level that the extra money that we would normally pay would go toward paying down your debt. Let's make law enforcement an attractive job to go to and not just make it just lock them up and throw away the key, but let's talk about how we can do community-based policing, how we can deal with kids who have trauma-informed care. Let's talk about how we can work through domestic violence shelters so that we can reduce those numbers down. Yes, we're going to have some hardcore policing that we have to do, but I believe the number of officers that you may need to do that may be less. But I also believe that as a community, as a state, a county, and a city, we should pay them more because we're getting better officers in. And we could make this job attractive by making it financially attractive. And then the other thing is making it emotionally rewarding for everyone.
Wondering, though, Assemblyman, with the pandemic stretching budgets paper thin all over the place, how can police departments offer these competitive salaries? Or, as you mentioned, offer some packages that could help reduce student debt? It just seems like the money might not be there to accomplish those goals.
I think that the money we save from the number of payouts in lawsuits in each individual municipality will more than compensate for bringing in smarter officers. If someone were, and I think somebody should do a study, if we were to just do a study on the amount of money we pay out because of officers doing things that are out of policy or out of procedures or just making mistakes is horrendous. Let's have that discussion about the money we save from having a better workforce in law enforcement.
Assemblyman, are you concerned at all that calls to defund the police might be counterproductive toward attracting the best and the brightest prospective officers?
I think we're saying the same thing. We just want to use our own language. When you talk to individuals about defunding the police, what you're hearing is frustration. You're hearing frustration from the public that we need to do something different. And in that frustration, you're hearing, let's just take all the money away from them and start all over again. Well, you probably will get to the same place that I'm at, making sure that the people that we want to handle the most heinous crimes are the best educated, the most mature there is. But on the other end, the ones that have to deal with just a misdemeanor, we need individuals that know the difference between a sandwich and a gun before you shoot somebody in the back. And that's what's frustrating for a lot of us in the African-American Latino community. A lot of us are dying because individuals may not be ready, truly ready to be officers. And we should weed them out at the beginning. This is what I'm hoping this will do, that we start weeding out individuals who may be white supremacists, which we find less educated people have a lot of biases because they're not going to college, not intermingling with other people, not having debates and educated conversations. You can disagree verbally, and you can disagree heatedly, but we have rules for that, and we need to follow them.
Now, according to the Department of Justice, police seriously hurt or killed civilians 703 times in 2019, and 40% of those times a gun was fired. In that Department of Justice report, the highest percentage of civilians involved by far were Latinos at nearly 45%. Your 59th Assembly District in South L.A. is 75% Latino. And I think way too often police use of deadly force conversations are framed through a white or black lens. I want to ask, what are you hearing from your constituents on police reform, specifically from Latinos?
In my district in general, Latino and African American, they want the police to show up at the door to protect them from violence. And what I've told law enforcement, since the lock them up and throw away the key days, since the over-incarceration days, things have changed. Now you have Latinos who are probably more afraid of law enforcement than they are of criminals, because law enforcement is working hand in hand a lot of times with ICE and detention centers, and they don't want their families broken up. And so I don't think law enforcement understands that right now, fear of not having your family together, fear of being deported, sometimes outweighs if there's a criminal act. In fact, I put a bill through that said that law enforcement, when someone that's undocumented reports a crime or testifies, they can't be deported. In the past, if you cooperated with the police and you weren't a citizen, you could get deported. And that didn't help with the relationship with law enforcement and the Latino community. Again, we've got to make law enforcement a little more robust in the way they think. Otherwise, this just, I'm a crime fighter. You committed a crime, I'll lock you up, and that's it. It doesn't work, and especially doesn't work in South Los Angeles.
That's California State Assembly Member Reggie Jones Sawyer from Los Angeles. Assembly Member, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
All right, the coronavirus rollout, coronavirus vaccine rollout is happening, and while it'll be a while before most people can get it, what would you say if your employer insisted that you take it as soon as you can, even if you prefer to wait? Would you be willing to sacrifice your job if you need to show proof of getting the vaccine before you can go to work? That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and available most places you find your podcasts. I'm Amy Martinez. Today marks the first day that U.S. healthcare workers are administering and receiving COVID-19 vaccination shots. Late on Friday, the Food and Drug Administration granted an emergency use authorization, or EUA, to the vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. Now, just so we're clear, an EUA means the product has not gone through the usual approval process. Now, the first vaccine doses are set aside for people with the highest need or at greatest risk. Think of frontline workers, the elderly, people with health conditions. So it will take a while before everyone has a chance to take a COVID-19 vaccine. But assuming everything else goes as planned, some people may be wondering what this means for their jobs. Specifically, will employers be able to mandate that their employees receive it? Here to talk about this, we reached out to Dori Rice. She's a professor of law at the University of California, Hastings, and a member of the Vaccine Working Group on Ethics and Policy. And she started off by telling us why this vaccine is a little bit of a EUU situation.
So in normal times, employers can set health and safety rules for the workplace, and that would include requiring vaccines. We've had employers require influenza vaccine in the past or hepatitis A vaccines. There are three limits, but in this vaccine, there's a wrinkle, which is that this vaccine is not approved in the usual way, but authorized under an emergency use authorization. And that's a little different. There's legal uncertainty on whether you can require a vaccine that's authorized under an EUA.
And she started off by telling me why this vaccine is a little different because of the EUA situation.
The language of the law says that you have to inform people that they can refuse the vaccine, but then also says you have to inform them of any consequences. And consequences might be being fired.
In the past, Professor, how has the FDA and the CDC interpreted the EUA law? Have there been vaccine mandates in the past for private employers or people in general? And if not, why?
So one of the things that you need to be aware of is that using an EUA for a vaccine is not usual. There's only been one case before, and that's use of anthrax vaccine to prevent anthrax attacks for the military only. So this is new territory. We have never had an EUA used to give a vaccine to the general population. The CDC and FDA have been commenting on this vaccine and saying that they think that you cannot mandate a vaccine under an EUA.
Now, when it comes to employers mandating a vaccine, what would be a few of the caveats that could thwart that?
So there's three caveats beyond the EUA. First, if you have a unionized workforce, your collective bargaining agreement may require negotiating with the union before you can impose the vaccine yourself. So you may have to negotiate with the union first. Second, two anti-discrimination laws affect this. First, the Americans with Disabilities Act says that if someone has a medical condition that prevents getting the vaccine, employers have to accommodate them unless it's an undue burden. What does that mean? It means the employer has to allow the employee with a disability to work unless it's a very, very high imposition on the employer. Now, accommodation doesn't necessarily mean letting them work like everybody else. It might mean letting them work with conditions such as wearing more PPE, being separated from other workers. The last part is that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 says that if an employee has a sincere religious objection to workplace rule, the employer has to accommodate them unless it's more than a minimal cost.
Now, you mentioned unionized workforces. I'm thinking specifically about school teachers because there's so much attention being paid to when schools can reopen, and many lawmakers are pushing for teachers and school administrators to be prioritized for a vaccine. But given that districts such as LA Unified employs union teachers, what might that process be like?
So first of all, a lot depends on the position of the union. Unions might support protecting their members by vaccinating and say, we want a vaccine mandate because we don't want the few workers that don't want to get the vaccine to put others at risk. Or unions may say, we're more concerned about the freedom of our workers and we want them to have the choice. So if the union is on board with the mandate, it's not an issue. The other thing is, what does the collective bargaining agreement actually say? Some of them would require negotiation and some of them would not. And that's very case specific.
But say, if it really comes to it, could an employer fire an employee for refusing to take the vaccine?
Yes, within those exceptions. It has happened in the past. For example, employees were fired for refusing an influenza vaccine, and it has been litigated. And in many cases, the court have upheld the firing of the employee. In some cases, for example, a settlement allowed the employee to come back or be compensated. And in other cases, the court allowed cases to go forward that later settled. I know of one case where a nurse who was fired for refusing a vaccine won on getting unemployment benefit, but they don't know of any case where an employer had to take back an employee who refused the vaccine.
We're speaking with Dorit Rice, a professor of law at the University of California, Hastings, and a member of the Vaccine Working Group on Ethics and Policy about whether or not employers can mandate COVID-19 vaccination for their employees. Now, Professor, back to schools for a second, because I'm thinking about the students here, not the employees. There was a debate yesterday on the FDA Advisory Council about recommending the vaccine to 16 and 17-year-olds. So could schools mandate that students receive a COVID vaccine in the future?
As you're suggesting, it'll be a while before it becomes very practical, because I don't see a lot of states going forward with the mandate when it's only authorized from 16 and up. But once trials are done in children, states will probably consider this. States already mandate for a K-12 a whole set of vaccines, and courts have traditionally given them high deference in which vaccine to mandate. So it's possible. Whether it's likely, if we're very lucky, by the time the vaccines are licensed for children, COVID-19 will be mostly under control, and states may not be inclined to go to the effort of adding that vaccine. More immediately, universities may well consider whether to mandate the vaccine for their students who are adults. And we know that some universities have seen outbreaks and that universities had to move to online, which creates challenges. And it may well be that universities will want to mandate COVID-19 vaccine, just as some have recently mandated the influenza vaccines.
We've seen reports of how a substantial part of the population is hesitant about these new vaccines. What problems do you foresee if employers do end up implementing mandates on this?
So the first thing for employers to remember is that mandates aren't the only tool in the toolbox and might not even be their first go-to. If the problem is high mistrust, enforcing a mandate can be very challenging. It might be better to start with an education campaign, a communication campaign, bring someone in who can answer questions about the vaccine. Mandates can be a really important additional tool, but they're not the solution for high levels of concerns or mistrust by themselves. The other thing to remember is legal framework is one thing. The question whether it's a good idea to mandate or not is another. If you know that 40% of your workforce are very scared of the vaccine, that might be a reason not to mandate, because you will have compliance issues that might make mandating less practical.
Yeah, if you're trying to get people to buy in on something, mandating it might be the wrong way to go. Wondering, is there the risk that private sector COVID-19 vaccine mandates could open up employers to lawsuits?
Yes. In the context of influenza vaccine mandates, employers have been sued in the past. I think we can expect that employers that mandate vaccine will face some litigation. If they follow the legal framework, the chances of winning such litigations are very good, but there probably will be lawsuits related to that.
That's Dorit Rice, professor of law at the University of California, Hastings, and a member of the Vaccine Working Group on Ethics and Policy. Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, all the best superheroes wear a mask. Sorry, this is the way. This is a year, though, when wearing a mask saves lives. So the superheroes that do cover their face while saving lives can lead by example. Find out how a local city is tugging on Superman's cape and not pulling the mask on the old Lone Ranger when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. I'm E. Martinez. Just before we continue with the show, Donald Trump just tweeted out that Attorney General Bill Barr is now through as his Attorney General. I'm sure we're going to hear more about this on All Things Considered with Nick Roman coming up later this afternoon. All right. Now, for those keeping count, which we all are, we're 10 months into this pandemic thing. After all this time, some people still don't regularly wear face masks out in public. Now, that's despite the pleas and sometimes some mixed messaging from public officials. Their tone is often very serious, peppered with facts, figures, and doom. But if those messages aren't working to convince the hard to reach, how about Yoda?
Masks are adorable. Adorable be you. Wear a f***ing mask, you must.
Now, that is not, obviously, an official by George Lucas, but it is an official public service announcement, or PSA, put out by the city of West Hollywood. I hope I don't get the giggles the rest of the show, please. Now, for years, it's produced some creative and occasionally subversive ways to get important messages out to the public, just like the one you just heard. We wanted to find out what other cities in SoCal can learn from WeHo about how to make targeted pleas for residents to take COVID safety precautions seriously. We have with us now Lisa Marie Belsanti, Director of Communications for the City of West Hollywood. Lisa, what was the thought process in using this kind of tone? Because it's obviously more funny and blunt than, say, what we might have heard from Barbara Ferrer.
A little bit, well, you know, I think a lot of folks in the region know that there is a WeHo way of being in the region, and that can be quite different than the rest of the region. So we gear all of our messaging towards the folks we know very well who live, work, and play in WeHo, just like we do. And we know through a lot of experience in public health messaging, going back to the city's formative years on HIV/AIDS, is that the scariest messages aren't always the most persuasive. Sometimes those one size fits all doom and gloom, if you do not comply, actually puts people in a more defensive posture, and it makes them feel even more isolated than they might be feeling right now in this pandemic. So laughter and levity and a little bit of bluntness, I think, is a way to get through to some of these folks.
Laughter always works with me, by the way. It just always works, as I remember it more than any other kind of message. Now, there's another video that really speaks right to my heart. It features a bunch of Marvel superheroes all in their own masks. Let's listen.
Masks are badass. Be a badass. Wear a f***ing mask.
Now, what does this mean about the population of West Hollywood, you think, of the demo you're trying to target? Because that's some good pop culture references that I, you know what, in this case, I do love the cursing.
Well, you know, it came out of, you know, we know that our community very well. And as well, we know the leadership that the city manager and the city council provide is, you know, take risks by all means. Let's just get the job done. And in our role and under this, you know, pandemic and the weight of it and the weight of public health messaging, you know, we got to certain points in the pandemic where we're just so frustrated. Like, why won't people just wear a mask? Like, that really was born out of
Thank you for your restraint, Lily, by the way. Thank you very much for that.
Yes.
Yeah.
You're welcome. But we heard from our partners at the county that they were having a particularly hard time with what folks in public health are calling the invincibles, like folks in the 18 to 29 year old age band, and they're particularly hard to reach. And, you know, we're really good at reaching those folks. Those of us who aren't in that age band act as if we are, or wish that we still were. Yeah. But these are the folks that really kind of pack our entertainment venues, who come, you know, weekday and weeknight, because they are more motivated by living life than worrying about the dangers that a public health crisis like this provide and the challenge.
Now, Lisa, you know, I had a mask slogan that I ran by, I believe it was an LA County supervisor, but I was told that it might be a little too dark. Mine was mask it or casket, mask it or casket. What do you think, since you're the messaging expert on this? Is that a little too dark?
No, I think for the county, since they're the ones ordering the coroners out. But for other folks, I think that there's a role for all of us to find messaging that works. So maybe the LA County coroner would do mask it or casket. Macabre way. You know, we're all thinking, what's going to be the magic slogan that's going to get people to mask up so we can get back to work? So we're just trying to tap into kind of like pop culture, comic culture, gay culture, common sense culture, and figure out what's going to make people be more compliant so we can all get back to our daily lives.
Common sense culturally. So that's the one culture I wish would be a little bit more prevalent, but regrettably it's not. Really quick. I mean, we're still in a critical stage though with this crisis and the virus, but what can other cities learn from West Hollywood about getting their own residents to practice correct coronavirus safety precautions?
We just, the City of West Hollywood, we tell our contemporaries, the folks who are really carrying the burden of communicating in these troubling times, to like really know your audience. Yeah. You know, if you have one demographic and they happen to be seniors, play to those seniors, know what seniors watch, know what seniors like, parody the stuff that they like. A lot of what we do to get around trademark.
Yeah,
stuff,
know the crowd, right?
Is the parody. Yeah, know the crowd. Yeah, yeah. So we're doing a lot of stuff that we know that our folks are into.
Lisa Marie Belasanti, Director of Communications for the City of West Hollywood. Lisa, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jay.
All right, thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.